Did you know you can opt out of winter? With Vrbo, save up to $1,500 for booking a month-long stay. When thousands of sunny homes are waiting for you, why subject yourself to the cold? Put the snow shovel down, put the parka back in the closet, and don't you dare scrape another windshield. Slip into some flip-flops, consider a sunless tan, and use the monthly stays filter to save up to $1,500. Book your warm getaway at Vrbo.com.
It's 5:05. Good Thursday morning to you, and welcome into the Carolina Journal News Hour, News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT. I'm Nick Craig. Well, the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history ended late Wednesday night after the House passed a clean continuing resolution in a 222-209 vote, and President Donald Trump signed off on the measure. He did that in the Oval Office shortly after 10 p.m. last night. This is what the president had to say.
For the past 43 days, Democrats in Congress shut down the government of the United States in an attempt to extort American taxpayers for hundreds of billions of dollars for illegal aliens and people that came into our country illegally from gangs, from prisons, from mental institutions. They wanted to pay them $1.5 trillion, which would have really hurt our healthcare businesses and our recipients at levels never seen before. Today, we're sending a clear message that we will never give in to extortion, because that's what it was. They tried to extort, the Democrats tried to extort our country. In just a moment, I'll sign a bill exactly like we asked Democrats to send us all along, many days ago. This cost the country $1.5 trillion, this little excursion that they took us on. Republicans never wanted a shutdown and voted 15 times for a clean continuation of funding. There's never been a time when one or the other party ever didn't sign a continuation. It's just a continuation, not a big deal. It's a continuation, and we'll talk later. Yet the extremists in the other party insisted on creating the longest government shutdown in American history, and they did it purely for political reasons. I want to thank Speaker Mike Johnson, Senate Majority Leader John Thune, as well as House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Majority Whip Tom Emmer, and numerous other great Republican leaders and congressmen and senators who are here, who frankly spent a long time in Washington getting this thing to go away. I also want to thank the broad coalition of Americans that stood with us in this fight to reopen government, including the Teamsters, the American Federation of Government Employees, the Fraternal Order of Police, AMVETS, the National Small Business Association, the American Farm Bureau, the American Trucking Association. These are all incredible patriots. The Airlines for America, the Allied Pilots Association, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, and many others, unions and non-unions over the past.
That's President Donald Trump in the Oval Office late Wednesday night talking about some of the ongoing political pressure that was going on and has been going on over the last 43 days as the federal government has been shut down. As I mentioned, the second to final measure was passing the United States House in a 222-209 vote, and then the president signing off on the measure. Six Democrats in the House voted with Republicans to pass the bill. One of those key votes came from a Democrat Representative Don Davis, who represents the first congressional district here in North Carolina. The General Assembly recently redrew Representative Davis's district to favor Republicans, giving them a slight edge, shifting it from essentially a toss-up district to an R+5. That is according to data from the John Locke Foundation, with many looking at Representative Davis's vote as an opportunity for him to speak to constituents across eastern North Carolina when his reelection comes forward next year. In a statement, Representative Davis said, quote, "Families in eastern North Carolina must remain the priority, which is why I initially voted against the original continuing resolution in the hopes of sincere discussion on extending the ACA, that's the Affordable Care Act, premium tax credits." Support for our military families, veterans, farmers, and those in need is now included in the updated continuing resolution. To support my constituents, alleviate the suffering of all of our families as the holidays approach, and bring vital resources to Eastern North Carolina, I voted to reopen the government. End quote there, or at least partial quote there, from Representative Don Davis. Some other reaction coming in from members of North Carolina's congressional delegation. Congressman David Arouser out of the 7th Congressional District posting on his X page last night, quote, "Glad to see the House pass the clean continuing resolution tonight. Now the bill heads to President Trump's desk for him to sign. With the government open, we must use the next 2.5 months to address our spending priorities responsibly," ending that quote there with an exclamation point. Congressman Tim Moore, who represents North Carolina's 14th congressional district, said, quote, "Senate Democrats spent 43 days holding the government hostage to extract political concessions, and they walked away with nothing to show for it. I voted to avoid this shutdown in September, and I'm proud not only to help reopen the government, but deliver more than $5.4 million in direct investments for Burke and Cleveland counties. These significant investments in our community will go to strengthen access to quality health care, expand educational resources, and support essential public services." Ending the quote there from Congressman Tim Moore. Now, the impacts on the government shutdown, which in the first few weeks were relatively minimal for most folks, unless you, of course, were a federal government employee, that has been changing over the last couple of weeks. SNAP benefits cutting off back on October the 1st for many individuals. More than 20,000 flights just over the last couple of days delayed or canceled due to a 10% reduction in the travel at 40 major airports across the United States. One of those 40 airports was Charlotte Douglas International, causing some big time travel headaches for individuals, even if you weren't flying in or out of one of those major impacted airports, RDU, Wilmington, Asheville, because so many flights connect through major hubs across the country. Some big time issues there. The FAA will now get all of their flight controllers back, their back pay. Hopefully many of them will show up to work today or tomorrow, and some of those flight restrictions will be released so that air travel can get back on track as we head into the Thanksgiving holiday. Congressman Greg Murphy, the Republican out of Congressional District 3, said, quote, "No one should ever hold the federal government and the American people hostage over partisan demands. Too many individuals and families suffered during this period of selfish behavior. Federal employees were without timely paychecks. Pay for our military service members was uncertain. Flights were canceled and delayed. SNAP payments were impacted, and many other benefits were put in limbo. This was all done to protect Senator Chuck Schumer's political career and push egregious demands of the progressive left. They failed. At last, we can put this nightmare behind us, and I look forward to getting back to the people's business." Some reaction also coming in from Congressman Addison McDowell. He is the Republican in the 6th Congressional District, saying, quote, "Americans have felt the pain caused by Democrats in D.C. for long enough. Today, I voted to reopen the government by supporting for a second time a funding bill that will ensure our skies get back to normal operations. Families do not go hungry, and thousands of government employees are paid and back to work. The House first passed a clean government funding bill at the end of September, and Senate Democrats voted to keep the government shut 14 times, spanning over 40 days, deciding to use the hardship of the American people as leverage in their political theater rather than govern responsibly for the betterment of the country." End quote there from Congressman Addison McDowell. The bill pushes the ongoing federal funding battle to January the 30th, the continuing resolution that was passed by the Senate on Monday, then passed by the House, signed by President Donald Trump Wednesday night. That current clean continuing resolution does keep that the government funded until January the 30th. However, House GOP leaders say that they expect to finalize a long-term agreement for the fiscal year 2026 over the next 2.5 months. Obviously, there will be a lot of pauses and breaks in Washington, D.C. as we roll into the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. So while 2.5 months sounds like it is a pretty decent amount of time with a lot of traveling and some other holidays coming up, that could very much put the federal government in a similar position that we just watched over the last 43 days unfolding as we head into late January. We will continue our coverage of the federal government shutdown. One piece of information to pass along to you this morning, at least on the travel standpoint, even with the federal government officially reopening this morning or late last night after the president signed off on the continuing resolution, the FAA is announced that the 10% reduction that was taking place at 40 major airports will be in the immediate term reduced to a 6% reduction. Obviously, the goal there would be to get all flights back operational and in the air. That 6% reduction, according to the FAA, will begin today. It's not immediately clear how long that will be in place. We'll keep an eye on the details right here on the Carolina Journal News Hour.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's 5:21. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour. News Talk 1110-99.3 WBT. I'm Nick Craig. Good morning to you. Carolina this week, as the very large and prominent car manufacturer Toyota held a ceremony to mark the opening and start of production at its first North American electric battery manufacturing plant. That is in Randolph County, North Carolina. To walk us through this and all of the individuals in attendance, a laundry list of very prominent people. Teresa Opeka, CarolinaJournal.com, joins us on the News Hour. Teresa, looking at your attendance list here at this event, I mean, you had everybody, senators, the transportation secretary, the governor. What's going on over in Randolph County?
Sure, Nick. Thanks for having me this morning. So, yeah, lots of people on the roster. Yesterday, we mentioned about North Carolina being host to Toyota's first North American electric battery manufacturing plant right in there in Liberty in Randolph County. And we had everybody from, you know, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, Senator Ted Budd, Governor Josh Stein. We had the Japanese ambassador. We had state senators, state representatives, county officials, town officials, and also, of course, officials from Toyota were all on hand to mark the occasion. Pretty big deal. Unfortunately, U.S. Rep. Richard Hudson was not able to make it because he was busy in D.C., you know, with everything going on with the federal government shutdown, and hopefully all that's behind us until January. it was a pretty big deal. And that the company first announced this back in 2021, that they plan to open that planned megasite. It spans about a little over 1,800 acres. And it's Toyota's largest investment in the U.S. at nearly $14 billion. So pretty big deal.
Well, Teresa, not only is this a pretty big deal, but you have unfortunately been the bearer of bad news over the last couple of months of a lot of these projects in this similar time frame, 2019, 2020, 2021, these announced projects. And Teresa, you've reported that many of them have not come to fruition. Toyota seems to be the exception to the rule on this. They're a full steam ahead, I guess, a full battery power ahead, probably more accurate way to describe it. This is a major story here for North Carolina.
So yes, it's a pretty big thing for Toyota because there were so many different announcements that unfortunately had fallen through in the past, over the last year and a half even, when we're talking about job goals for many of these companies that were planning to create so many jobs. Many of them, of course, were getting grant money, job development or JDIG grant money from the state, if in fact they held up to their end of the bargain creating so many jobs. And again, stress this, they did not get that money from the state if they didn't create those jobs. So by Toyota actually having this come to fruition, they have over 2,500 employees right now. They're expecting to actually have a total of 5,100 when all is said and done. So that's a pretty good deal for the state of North Carolina and for the people working there. We're talking about a plant that's going to have does have on-site child care center, medical clinic, and pharmacy, which is great. And what this this plant does, it's going to have several shops that specialize in various stages of lithium-ion battery manufacturing process. And according to a press release put out by Toyota, the batteries assembled there are going to go into the Camry HEV and also Corolla vehicles and another yet-to-be-announced all-electric three-row BEV. That's the first of its kind for Toyota to be built in the U.S. This state-of-the-art facility is also the 11th manufacturing facility in the U.S. One more thing, too. It will feature 14 production lines, including four dedicated to supporting battery production for hybrid electric vehicles, and also 10 dedicated for battery production for battery electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So a lot of that going on, pretty big deal. And as we said, it's great that it did come to fruition, especially when so many things have not.
Well, Teresa, you mentioned 2,500 or so workers right now and some of the sprawling nature of that campus with all of the amenities for their employees. They plan on scaling that up to close to 5,000, if not more, employees. That'll happen in the coming months and years. But Teresa, this is interesting because we've talked about another car manufacturer, another company that planned on building a facility here in North Carolina known as VinFast. They predominantly were focusing on electric vehicles, and we've seen a huge drop in demand on those, not only across the United States, but worldwide. So it is interesting to see Toyota not only opening this facility, but as you noted in the intro, their largest U.S. facility primarily focusing on battery technology.
Yes, in fact, you're right. I'm talking about VinFast, who said they're still coming to North Carolina in 2028. We'll have to wait and see on that one. But yeah, demand for EVs has fallen. I know that the tax credit has gone away for them as well. But one thing to be noted, it's going to be building for electric vehicles, but also hybrids. And that's what USDOT Secretary Sean Duffy emphasized too, that, you know, Toyota listened to what consumers really wanted. He said they didn't cave to political pressure. Consumers wanted basically hybrids. You know, they want some gas power, but hybrids. So basically electric with a backup of a combustion engine. So maybe the main focus will be switching primarily to hybrids, but you know, there is some EVs mixed in with this too.
Yeah, and the hybrids is kind of interesting when you look at the kind of the technology around the car market. Toyota was one of the first with the Prius to introduce some of this hybrid technology. Teresa, that was gaining some steam, and then all of a sudden there was this huge emphasis on just ditching the internal combustion engine and going straight to EV. There was a push on that for a couple of years. A lot of that was due to state and federal subsidies across the nation. But as the American populace has decided that, hey, you know, there's charging station infrastructure isn't there, and 45 minutes to an hour to charge to continue on the commute is not the best way to do it, we are starting to see kind of this resurgence in the hybrid level technology, which I think is a lot more practical for the vast majority of drivers.
Yes, it definitely is. And especially when you're talking people in rural areas, I mean, you're not going to get much of a charge. The charge isn't going to last for those who have to travel a great ways. So, that is very concerning for people like that. And, you know, that's why they mainly stick to gas engines or a hybrid. Hybrid's the best of both worlds, right? So you get a little bit of the electric and you also have gas. So, yeah, it just makes sense to focus mainly on hybrids at this point. Or if you still want that combustion engine itself, then drive that's just something that's gasoline powered.
Teresa, you have got some quotes from Secretary Duffy, from Senator Ted Budd, and even some videos embedded in our story this morning. Where can folks go and get those details?
Sure, they can head on over to carolinajournal.com.
We appreciate the information this morning. Teresa Opeka from carolinajournal.com joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour. It's 5:36. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour. News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT. Just a heads up coming up. We're going to have a special program coming up for you tomorrow morning as we will have our latest October Carolina Journal poll. We are going to be asking voters and have asked voters about a variety of issues, including, of course, the approval rating of President Donald Trump and Republicans, looking ahead to the very important United States Senate race that will be heading to North Carolina very quickly, that primary taking place in March of next year before the general election in November, plus a variety of other issues and topics. So hopefully you can join us coming up tomorrow morning right here on the Carolina Journal News Hour. If you can't join us live, don't forget that you can check out the show on demand in your favorite podcast app. Just search for the Carolina Journal News Hour, tap the subscribe or follow button, and you'll get a new program delivered each and every weekday morning. You can also watch live and demand by visiting our Carolina Journal YouTube account as well. That link is available over on our website this morning, carolinajournal.com. One of the legal stories that we've been tracking for the last couple of months right here on the Carolina Journal News Hour involves the state health plan and exclusion of certain treatments that would likely be used by individuals that are going through some sort of gender transition. We do have a update on that lawsuit this morning to bring us up to date. Mitch Kokai with the John Locke Foundation joins us on the News Hour this morning. Mitch, we chatted about this maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago. There were some decisions in other states that may have been having an impact. What's the latest with this North Carolina State Health Plan lawsuit?
Well, the latest is that all parties in the suit basically want to put the case on hold. And the reason for that is that the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fourth Circuit is the one that North Carolina cases go to. So the Fourth Circuit is hearing an almost identical case out of West Virginia. And the arguments in that case are going to be taking place in early December. And then at some point afterward, the Fourth Circuit will come up with a ruling. And basically, all of the parties in this case, on one side, the state health plan, which has an exclusion that blocks coverage for these what the proponents call gender-affirming care. But if you don't like to use that language, you could say the medical treatments that are usually requested by transgender patients. So there's the state health plan on one side. And then on the other side are the patients and their lawyers who would like the state health plan to cover these treatments. Back in 2022, a district judge put an injunction in place that blocked the state health plan from excluding the treatments, meaning that the state health plan would have to cover the treatments. And the Fourth Circuit upheld that ruling. But afterward, the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a ruling in a case out of Tennessee called Skirmetti that said that Tennessee's law that banned the gender treatments for teens was constitutional. And so after that ruling, the Supreme Court went back to this North Carolina case and said, Fourth Circuit, you need to reconsider this case in light of what we said in Skirmetti. Once the case got back to the Fourth Circuit threw out the injunction and sent the case back to the trial court. So presumably this is going to go through all of the trial court items, a trial and such. But before that happens, all of the sides in the case say, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense for us to go through all of this trouble at this point when the Fourth Circuit's going to take up almost the exact same issue out of West Virginia. Let's go ahead and see how that case plays out. And then afterward, within a couple of weeks of the final ruling in the West Virginia case, then we'll provide another status report about how this case moves forward. So basically, what is in place right now is that the state health plan, after the ruling from the Fourth Circuit that threw out the injunction, the state health plan put the exclusion back in place. So the state health plan is not covering these treatments now. And that's the status quo. That will remain until a court decides something one way or the other about this. But that's not going to happen for a while because all of the parties in the case have agreed, let's put this on hold until the Fourth Circuit decides something in this West Virginia case, which is called Anderson v. Crouch.
Mitch, this might sound like a stupid question, but when you've got both sides saying, hey, let's kind of tap the brakes on this thing, we've got a similar case that is also under the Fourth Circuit's jurisdiction taking place, is that something that the court almost all of the time says, okay, we agree with, or is there a possibility that the court says, no, we're going to move forward with this anyway?
Well, it's possible that the court would decide to move forward with it, but unlikely, because with all sides agreeing and saying that the case that's in front of the Fourth Circuit from West Virginia deals with almost the exact same issues. You know, if the court looked at it and said, yeah, that's slightly different, you're dealing with some different issues here, we should probably go ahead with your case now, that could happen. But but generally, if all sides agree that this West Virginia case will almost certainly decide what is at issue in the North Carolina case, it makes a lot of sense for judicial economy and efficiency just to allow the West Virginia case to play out. Another factor that's important here is that we don't really know at this point who the judge is. The judge who issued the injunction back in 2022, District Judge Loretta Biggs, is no longer assigned to this case. At some point in this past year, there was a court order that said she's no longer assigned to the case. And if you look at all of the information that's online from the U.S. court system, the case is unassigned. And so we don't even know which judge is going to be overseeing this. So my guess is it's very likely that the court system just says, okay, we'll keep this on hold. We don't have to worry about it, at least for a while. And then once the Fourth Circuit comes up with a ruling in the West Virginia case, the Anderson case, then you can go back and see what needs to be done in terms of this North Carolina case. It could be that whatever judge is assigned to this says, well, based on what the Fourth Circuit said in Anderson, this is how we have to rule in this case. And probably all sides will agree. And whoever is on the losing side will sort of jump on to whatever appeal comes from the Fourth Circuit to try to get something to the Supreme Court.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. You talk about this court date coming up in December in another state, but still under the Fourth Circuit's jurisdiction. Mitch, it's probably hard to argue that regardless of who wins or loses that case, somebody will be appealing that from the Fourth Circuit, likely to the nation's highest court. So it could be months, if not years, for that West Virginia case to be dealt with. In the meantime, everything might just kind of be standing by here in the state of North Carolina. And as you just mentioned, due to some of the previous rulings from the nation's highest court, those transgender exclusions are currently in place in the state of North Carolina.
They are. And that's one of the reasons why it's sort of interesting that the plaintiffs in this case would be willing to go along with setting everything to the side and getting a stay. Because at this point, we are a pre-injunction status quo where the exclusion was in place and it was being challenged. So right now we have the exclusions back in place. The plaintiffs want to get rid of the exclusions, but they don't have the injunction. So there's nothing that helps them in this case, and nothing can help them in this case unless they get a favorable ruling from the Fourth Circuit. But I do think it's to their credit that the plaintiffs did not try to go back and say, well, that Scarametti case from the U.S. Supreme Court, it did not do anything that changes our injunction. You should restore that injunction and then wait to see what the Fourth Circuit would do and perhaps have that injunction lifted a second time. They basically said, look, the West Virginia case is arguing the same issues that we're arguing. We should just set this aside for now, see what the Fourth Circuit says in that case, and then go back and see how it affects the North Carolina case. It's entirely possible that both sides in this case look at the West Virginia case, look at what happened at the U.S. Supreme Court in Scarametti and think, they're likely to win. And so they won't have to do as much in the North Carolina case if they can go ahead and bank on the Fourth Circuit ruling in their favor.
And of course, we will keep an eye on that case in West Virginia as we head into the month of December and some of those ramifications possible here in North Carolina. We appreciate the update and analysis this morning. Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour. Nothing says joy like a kid getting a brand new bicycle for Christmas, and that means it's time for Hancock's Bikes for Kids. We're asking you to consider bringing a new bike to WBT on Friday, December the 5th from 5 to 9 p.m. The entire team will be there to thank you for your generous donation as the 32nd annual WBT Hancock's Bikes for Kids event takes place, benefiting Kids First of the Carolinas. It is also presented by Garage Door Doctor. Put it on your calendar Friday, December 5th, 5 to 9 p.m. Visit WBT.com this morning for additional event details. It's now 5:52 on the Carolina Journal News Hour, News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT. The big international news this morning, or national news this morning, is that the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history ended late Wednesday night after the House passed a clean continuing resolution in a 222-209 vote, and President Donald Trump signed off on the measure. Six Democrats in the House voted with Republicans to pass the bill. One of those key six votes came from Representative Don Davis, who is a Democrat in North Carolina's first congressional district. This is relevant as the General Assembly recently redrew Representative Davis's district to favor Republicans, shifting it from an R+1 to an R+5, according to data from the John Locke Foundation. Representative Davis said in a Wednesday night statement, quote, "Support for our military families, veterans, farmers, and those in need is now included in this updated continuing resolution. To support my constituents and alleviate the suffering of our families as the holidays approach and bringing vital resources to eastern North Carolina, I voted to reopen the government." President Trump in the Oval Office Wednesday night saying, quote, "For the past 43 days, Democrats in Congress shut down the government of the United States in an attempt to extort American taxpayers for hundreds of billions of dollars for illegal aliens. Today, we are sending a clear message that we will never give in to extortion." A lot of other reaction coming in from members of Congress as a part of North Carolina's congressional delegations, all of them slamming Senate and House Democrats over the last 43 days. This current legislation pushes the ongoing federal funding battle to January the 30th. So that is the next opportunity. If the major appropriation bills do not go forward, that will be the next shutdown date. However, it is again kicked all the way to the end of January 2026. We will have a continued coverage this morning over on our website, carolinajournal.com. In some other major statewide news this morning, Toyota, yes, the major car manufacturer, held a ceremony to mark the opening and start of production at its first North American electric battery manufacturing plant. That facility is in Liberty. That is in Randolph County, North Carolina. It was a packed house for the event yesterday, including Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, Senator Ted Budd, Governor Josh Stein, many other members of the North Carolina General Assembly, all welcoming in Toyota and congratulating them on the opening of this facility. The company did announce back in 2021 that it planned to open this mega site, which spans more than 1,800 acres, and to date is Toyota's largest investment in the United States at a whopping $14 billion. The plant currently has more than 2,500 workers, but its plans are to have a final workload of about 5,100 people. The plant, which is Toyota's 11th manufacturing facility in the United States, will feature 14 production lines, including four dedicated to supporting battery production for hybrid electric vehicles, with 10 others dedicated to supporting battery production for batteries in electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. The state-of-the-art facility features several shops that specialize in various stages of lithium-ion battery manufacturing technology. Production is divided into three main parts: electrode manufacturing, cell assembly, as well as formation and module. So this is a major announcement, not only for Toyota, which is a Japanese-based company, but a major business investment in North Carolina with this facility officially opening and having that welcoming ceremony in Randolph County on Wednesday. This, of course, comes on the heels of what has been a lot of bad news in some of these major business announcements over the last year or year and a half. We have brought you a lot of those, unfortunately, here on the Carolina Journal News Hour and on our website, carolinajournal.com. Many of these business announcements from 2018, 2019, 2020, due to the rapidly evolving and changing economic conditions, were unable to follow through on their plans to open, in some cases, massive facilities in North Carolina. However, this morning, Toyota being the exception to that rule, we have got a full rundown of this business announcement, including some comments from Sean Duffy, Governor Josh Stein, and more. All of that available over on our website, CarolinaJournal.com. That's going to do it for a Thursday edition. WBT News is next, followed by Good Morning BT. We're back with you tomorrow morning, 5 to 6, right here on News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT.